So, for reasons I'm not quite sure of, I sense that somehow I didn't have an argument that unfolded at the second hour last week. So I want to see if I can really get a string that's going to give us an account of the meaning of self-consciousness in general today, and we'll see how it goes. To repeat, or I think I'm repeating it, I kind of lost track of where I am. The claim of the master-slave dialectic is that we only become truly self-conscious, or self-consciousness only begins to become explicit in a moment of radical fear. Only in the confrontation with a threat that forces us to overcome our relationship to the natural world, can we achieve a truly human orientation towards ourselves and the world? Or to put the same point another way, what is at stake in the first instance is overcoming the authority of nature. And the theme of how we overcome the authority of nature, which I take to be the meaning of subjectivity. That is, I take the two things to be coextensive. That is, the surrender of the authority of nature, natural desire, and the institution of self-consciousness as our authoritative relationship to the world are equivalent terms. And that this thought of this uprooting of the self in a violent moment as the condition for becoming self-consciousness is, as I think I suggested, a theme throughout modern philosophy. I suggested that that theme first becomes apparent in Descartes, in the moment of the evil demon. The evil demon is someone who is threatening the authority of the subject, threatening their natural teachings, threatening their relationship to the world, threatening what they can trust and not trust, until that moment where they must give up everything and discover the cogito. So it's only in a moment of terrible threat where the self is forced to give up everything that it becomes self-conscious. It says, I think. It says, I. It says, I only under the exigency of terror. And that moment is repeated in Hobbes. And although we think of Hobbes the materialist and Descartes the idealist, it's important to note that when, I guess it was The Behemoth, was published anonymously, a lot of people attributed it to Descartes. That is, it...
So that the
Descartes, Hobbes were thought to be doing something similar. And of course, in Hobbes, it is the same thing. The whole point of the state of nature, right, is to put the self with its natural desires and natural beliefs into a situation in which they pursue them naturally. And if they pursue them naturally with their natural beliefs, right, there is a war of all against all in which they must then give up those natural beliefs and take on a different standpoint, the standpoint of politics. Politics emerges as a moment of coming to self-consciousness. The face-to-face with the other who wants nothing but my death tells me I better have a policeman around. So both Descartes and Hobbes begin by treating the individual as a self-interested, egoistic agent. And what Descartes achieves through a method of doubt, Hobbes achieves through a phenomenology of doubt. That is, the state of nature is a mechanism to bring about doubt. Doubt, namely, about the belief that if I can succeed in my endeavors, that's what's wrong, that's our natural vanity, that's the sin of pride. That is, we are forgetful of death. We are forgetful of death. And the Leviathan, as a text, I believe, is itself meant to be, I can argue about your text, but I think the actual text is meant to be, remember death. That's what I think the text is, a memento mori. And it was meant to be that in the situation of the Civil War. Divided parliaments and all that. That was sort of that. So Hegel is taking up this theme, but this theme, you may say, goes back as far as Plato. After all, Plato says that those little denizens sitting in the cave, happily watching the shadows, have to be torn away. They don't want to stop watching the shadows, and they have to be torn, ripped out of the cave, and dragged out into the sunlight. Why this violence? Why this violence? Same thought. What is the cave? The cave is the authority of nature. The teaching that things are as they appear to be, the truth of semblance. In the basement of this work, there's a wonderful PhD written here by Richard Kennington on Descartes' teaching of nature. And it will tell you how much of the structure of Descartes' meditations is about how we have the teaching of nature is, this is what Descartes is struggling with, things are as they appear to be. And that actually is just false. That's why we have to give up that teaching of nature. So things aren't as they appear to be. Things are actually made up of invisible corpuscles. That's what Descartes thought, right? He really thought the world was written in the language of mathematics. So, fear of death creates self-consciousness. Again, Kant's moral law. The moral law is supposed to sting my vanity. It's supposed to humble me. It's supposed to threaten me. Is supposed to be awesome and sublime. And its sublimity is necessary because I need to be again shaken out of my natural desires. And of course I also have something to attain, right? Moral law is also again both superego and ego ideal, who is those two roles in one. Hegel is trying to work out the meaning of that claim. That claim about subjectivity, the meaning of subjectivity is the overcoming of the authority of nature. And we attain that in a moment of radical fear. And we come to a moment of self-consciousness. And self-consciousness is, and I'll say a lot more about this in about 40 minutes, the meaning of self-consciousness is the origin of a second spring of action. A second spring of action. I mean by that, nothing complicated, it's Platonic thought. One spring of action we know, natural desires. They move us to action. I desire something, I do it. What all of these characters are trying to suggest is there is a second spring of action, called reason. Plato calls them ideas. For Hobbes, it remains instrumental reason, but the difference between the beginning and the end is the difference between short-term and long-term instrumental reasoning in Hobbes.
Fear is reason for Hobbes.
What?
Fear is reason.
Fear is, well, yes, fear is, but for all of them, I think it's reason. So we have to come about a second meaning or a second origin, a second formation, a second source of something that moves us to action other than natural desires, other than those desires we are given with. And the question is, where do they come from? How do we develop them? What do they mean? And no one actually answered these questions, I think, prior to Hegel. That's my point. No one actually answers this question prior to Hegel. They take it, they all go for a Platonic story, that there is this other realm, the moral law, the laws of reason, even in Hobbes, in Descartes, the ideas. No one has an account of the origin of reason, shall we say, and the meaning of reason. And that's what I believe Hegel is after. And he thinks that, again, has something to do with the very idea of self-consciousness, of being self-aware in the appropriate way. So, to be... Sure.
Aren't you using reason in the philosophy before you get the self-consciousness? I mean, isn't it reason if you say, you know, the blackboard is black or something? Isn't that reason already? Or, you know, that's not reason, but, I mean, aren't you using reason? I mean, it seems to me that reason and self-consciousness are not the same. And why does reason necessitate self-consciousness? It seems to me self-consciousness adds something to reason.
Right. It's authority. We, from the moment of perception, we start using reason in the sense that we start using universals and we start manipulating things in accordance. And in science, we're obviously reasoning. What we don't have any understanding of is the authority of reason. Reason is out there, right? It's realism. Reason, self-consciousness, is our self-determination. So this is how we discover the authority of reason. It's not reason itself, but the authority of reason. So we're overcoming the authority of nature and moving to the authority of reason. So exactly the right question. Yeah. Okay. So we learned that to be a self-conscious agent, it is necessary to be a living agent, and to be aware of oneself as a living agent, which is why the original battle for independence is self-defeating. Life is a necessary condition for self-consciousness. But the idea of the battle, that it is a necessary condition for self-consciousness, because it reveals something about, or the beginning of the meaning of norms themselves. That is, the very idea of norms, or values, or reason, is that it is the sort of thing that can trump natural desires and inclinations. That is, ask us to give them up. We cannot be self-conscious agents unless we operate according to norms for which we are willing to sacrifice our lives. And hence we generate the... a double characterization of natural life and death and spiritual life and death. So in order to preserve its natural life, the slave accepts spiritual death. It gives up the hope of independence. It gives up its idea that it is self-determining. It is determined by the other. The master we saw is someone who, because he is willing to die, he believes he attains spiritual life. That is the authority of self-consciousness, the self, or selfhood, apart from the authority of nature. Of course, all that's false, because they are bound together. Nonetheless, the slave sacrifices spiritual recognition for staying alive. That is what makes the slave a slave. And both the future master and the future slave come to recognize that life is necessary, and hence they must be in relationship to one another. We further saw last week that the position of the master is non-dynamic, that it goes nowhere, that the master, in a sense, returns to the position of a natural being for two reasons, maybe three, at least for a couple of reasons. First, of course, the truth of the master is a master because he has a slave. That is, he is recognized by a being he does not recognize. Hence, he is recognized by a thing. So, in some sense, he is reduced to the very thinghood he disdains. Secondly, he returns to a self-identity because he does not act. He simply consumes. He consumes whatever he desires because the slave gives it to him. But because all he does is consume or die, that's all masters do, then there's nowhere for the master to go. Which is to say, the very position of mastery is non-dynamic. It has no possibility of learning, transformation. Learning and transformation. So Hegel wants to introduce an account by saying, and here's the interesting thought, we enter into the battle, the struggle for life and death, in order to attain independence. It turns out that freedom cannot be won immediately. Freedom is not something you possess the way you might possess a watch. Freedom is an accomplishment of an elaborate process. And I'll say how elaborate it is in a moment. But it is something that is not given. It is a result. And it's a result of a complex set of transformations in social relations. Already now, freedom is becoming odd. Because I can't attain freedom by asserting my absolute independence. So my freedom is not being absolutely independent. Rather, freedom is a condition of the right kind of dependence. Which sounds like a contradiction in terms. But that, of course, is the core Hegelian thought, that freedom is going to be finding the formation of my relationship to another that is not self-defeating, but emancipating. We have no idea what that is. Neither do the master-slave, and there's no easy way to find it. So the question is, how is the intersubjective relation between master and slave going to be made into a dynamic process? What is required is for it to be a process which allows for, remember I said that it's all about the authority of nature, what which allows for the continual overcoming of nature within and without. And I think if we had, rather than history is history of recognition as it is for Kozhev, we could better say that history is the process of overcoming nature within and without. Makes it sound a lot like Marx. It should. He didn't base his entire work on this section for nothing. Right. So this is get the structure going. Okay. Hegel put forward two ineliminable conditions for the achievement of self-consciousness. Fear of death and service work for another. First, fear of death, paragraph 194. Middle of the paragraph, maybe about a third of the way down. For this consciousness has been fearful, not of this or that particular thing, or just at odd moments, but its whole being has been seized with dread. In that experience, it has been quite unmanned, has trembled in every fiber of its being, and everything solid and stable has been shaken to its foundation. But this pure universal movement, the absolute melting away of everything stable, is the simple, essential nature of self-consciousness. This movement of everything stable being dissolved into nothingness is the essential, simple movement of self-consciousness, absolute negativity, pure being for self, which consequently is implicit, notice implicit, in this consciousness. This moment of pure being for self is also explicit for the bondsman, for in the Lord it exists as his object. Okay. So, this is what I've tried to begin diagramming on the board here. So, we're talking about something like an original trauma, or maybe an original castration. Anyway, the question is, how are we to overcome the attitude, let's call it the natural attitude, which takes any givens within ourselves or within external nature as givens that cannot be altered? Think of everyone who lives in Iowa. It's all just the way it is, right? Nothing's ever going to change. We don't want it to change. It is what it is. Okay. What's going to make Iowa change? Hegel's answer is that only the fear of death makes everything stable and solid appear not to be so. And what he means by this is that we don't know what is transformable and what not. We don't know what we can change or not, what we can do or not, until we are put to the test. Until we are faced with necessity. Only necessity challenges the authority of settled desires, habits, customs, and the like. So that but we need a fear of death that is not sporadic. We need a conception of the fear of death that has a structure to it. So we need an account of the fear of death in which that experience of fear, that is, a willingness to give up anything and everything, becomes itself a settled disposition. That's what the master-slave relationship is. It is the institution of the fear of death. So when Hegel says that this moment of being for self is also explicit in the bondsman, for in the Lord it exists as his object, it is now the Lord himself who is death. That's what mastery means to the slave. Mastery means you must give up everything or die. You must surrender everything to me or die. So Hegel says the absolute fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The Lord is death. So, for Hegel, the fear of death is given structure, is given stability, and is given objective form in the person and the presence of the master, and that therefore the institution of slavery, and it's an institution. Indeed, it's the first institution. It's the idea of institution itself. It is the institutionality of there being institutions whatsoever. Lucanians will call it the law of the father. In the person and presence of the master. So with the experience of slavery, the fear of death is socialized. It becomes incorporated into a social relation capable of indefinite historical mutation. The social relation can take on any number of possible forms. It can be social, economic, or political. It may exist between individual persons, or groups of persons, or classes, or nations. Structure would be the same. That's what Marx wanted out of the relationship between bourgeois and proletariat. Exactly that. Hence, it is only with the socialization that the fear of death can become efficacious in shaping attitudes and activities. And it's this institution that is going to then lead to the structure ironically, of human self-creation. Why? Because the first thing and the most prominent thing about the meaning of the socialization of the fear of death is it is equivalent to the socialization of the repression of natural desire. As what it is fundamentally to be a slave is to be willing to give up all your natural desires. And further, not only to give up all your natural desires, but obviously to act and to act only on the desires of another. This is a strange kind of being to be a master and slave. The slave is someone who acts on the desires of another and therefore does actions that are not his actions but the actions of another. And the slave is the body of the master. So it's as if the master-slave relationship is a kind of Cartesian dualism, where the master is a kind of mind and the slave is a kind of body. And they are related in this social relation of mutual dependency. So the risk of life in the battle for recognition token the dismissal of the drive for self-preservation. That moment, I argued, is gratuitous and unprecedented. It marks the transition point between the world of needs and drives on the one hand and what I'll call the world of desire on the other. The natural world is splintered with the demand for independence. Need becomes desire when the object of consciousness itself possesses spiritual autonomy. So initially, then, it is the desire for independence which is transformed. But through the standing fear of death represented by the presence of the master, by the institution of the master-slave relation, all desires become subject to repression. Since no desire that I have can be taken for granted, then every desire I have is subject to reflective evaluation. Social accreditation, legitimation, or repression. So, what I'm trying to get to here is this thought that we must give up the idea that what it means to give up the authority of nature is to give up the idea that to have a desire is to have a reason for action. And if you're all in AU doing the U course, you'll know that U just takes that as analytic. To have a desire is to have a reason for action. Indeed, all of analytic philosophy that uses a kind of Eumean philosophy of mind thinks that to have a desire is to have a reason for action. And Hegel's saying, absolutely not. Since desires in our, what we desire is part of our understanding of who we are, that is, how I understand what I desire and what I most desire is part of who I take myself to be. It follows that the master-slave dialectic has an abiding form of self-understanding and social interaction, creates a context where we are continually reflecting on who we are and who we want to be and transforming it in accordance with our understanding of the situation, namely what the master wants. If the master suddenly wants a pyramid, then suddenly I have a great desire to build pyramids. And then I take myself to be the kind of being who is a pyramid builder, and then I have ideas about the pyramid. And I say to the master, look, this pyramid thing works better in steps. And the master, because the master's never done paid work in his life, has to listen to me and say, yeah, that's what I want. I want a pyramid with steps. So the master is having to acknowledge his dependence on the slave, and the slave is transforming his self-understanding through reshaping himself and his social context. But this dynamic relationship does not take place in an idealistic vacuum with nothing but fear and desire and self-evaluation at its elements. The stabilization of repression of desire prepares the way for the social appropriation and transformation of nature. By transforming, as I suggested last week, the forest into the farm, we give human shape to the world. So when I repress my desire for this object, I am also repressing it as the given object of my desire. That is, now we're talking about, I said we have to give up, overcome nature within, we also have to overcome nature without. And that, Hegel says, is the business of work. So desire done, action done under conditions of repressed desire, actions done by acting on the desires of another, Hegel calls work. Hegel states that the experience of slavery is the dissolution of everything stable, not only in principle, in the slave's service he brings this about, I'm quoting, through his service he rids himself of his attachment to natural existence in every single detail and gets rid of it by working on it. Gets rid of it by working on it. Now the working on it is working on himself and working on the thing. So the experience of slavery is the transformation of random and chaotic activity into specifically human work. Work is the socialization of the human capacity for intelligent activity. But without the discipline of servitude, activity could not be transformed into work. You're not going to do your homework unless you're going to get punished if you don't. You're not going to clean out the girl. You know, all the reasons that we are forced to discipline our activities. that there is no learning without discipline. So work is discipline. Discipline occurs through the repression of desire and acting on the desire of another. So what makes work for Hegel is it's being done for another. So if all desire is the other's, then my action is also, in a sense, the action of another. But also, as we'll see, mine. So Kojève nicely says, the slave who works for the master represses his instincts in relation to an idea, a concept. Build me a pyramid. How about a cannon? A palace. A really tasty sandwich. And that is, so each of these, I want to say, are ideas that are invested with meaning. And they're invested with meaning via their mediated character, right? It is because the master wants them that you have to figure out the meaning of what would satisfy that desire. So, and it is just this, acting in accordance with an idea, a concept, that is what makes his activity specifically human activity. I'm still quoting Kojève. By acting, he negates, he transforms the given nature, his nature, and he does it in relation to an idea, to what does not exist in the biological sense of the word, in relation to an idea of a master. That is an essentially social, human, historical notion. Hegel says, work, on the other hand, is desire held in check, fleetiness staved off. In other words, work forms and shapes things. Through the structured repression of desire and service for another, the self's desires and acts are socialized. Through the slave's formative activity, nature is transformed in accordance with human desires and ideas. Hence, the experience of slavery is the beginning of the overcoming of nature within and without. We've actually entered into the domain of the spiritual. That is, we've entered into a domain where authority is not the authority of nature, but the authority of ideas, values, meaning, etc. I mean, of course, the battle for life and death is between two people. right? And therefore the battle can't end. I mean, all of that is about two people. But I'll get to why the structure, the master-slave structure itself requires two people. The way of getting there is to ask the question, why on earth is this an account of self-consciousness? And in what sense is this structure a structure that is both inter-psychic and intra-psychic, both social and internal, both social and individual? And why must it be both, and what makes it both? And in order to get at this, I actually want to use... oddly enough, but for reasons that we'll come to, I want to adopt a characterization of self-consciousness of an explicitly empiricist kind from Harry Frankfurt. And the reason I want to begin with an empiricist account is because the problem with rationalist accounts is they already have the two structures going. And the great thing about empiricists is they're always trying to generate all the complexity out of one level of phenomena. So Frankfurt, in a famous paper called Freedom of the Will and the Concept of a Person, how many of you know this paper? Is this familiar? Just a few. You all ought to know it. This is a really standard piece of analytic literature. He's the guy who wrote the book on bullshit. Same guy. Interesting analytic philosopher. Interesting Descartes scholar, too. Frankfurt suggests that the possession of states of consciousness and corporeal characteristics are shared by many creatures other than human beings. Lots of animals are conscious and have bodies. And therefore, the possession of two types of predicates, consciousness and bodily predicates, does not separate the human from the non-human, the spiritual from natural beings. What demarcates persons as unique, he says, is the possession of what he calls second-order volitions. So here's the idea. I'll quote Frankfurt and then I'll elaborate. He says, besides wanting and choosing and being moved to do this or that, human beings also want to have or not have certain desires and motives. They are capable of wanting to be different in their preferences and purposes from what they are. No animal other than man, however, appears to have the capacity for reflective self-evaluation that is manifested in the formation of second-order desires. Okay, so the story is this. We all have first-order desires. We desire this or that. But now there comes a question. Do I desire to have the desires I have? So, I'm really puzzled. So, in my case, right, I certainly have always a perpetual desire for a cigarette. And, of course, I would desire that I not have that desire. So, Frankfurt's thought is that we have to separate freedom of the will from freedom of action. Freedom of action, which is what Hume talks about, is simply being able to do what I desire without coercion. So I am free to act if I am not impeded from pursuing the desires I have. I have freedom of the will, however, only if I have the desires I desire. Now, what's important here is this. I want to get this structure in its deepest possible way. Under what conditions can I call a desire mine? So I'm interested here in what makes anything mine, my action, my desire. And we know that there has been, from the beginning of this chapter, a question of mindness. We started out with desires, and I wanted all the world to be mine. And it turned out it wasn't mine, right? The mindness that I thought I possessed in desiring kept getting impeded, that it was not mine. So we're now saying that there's a question about what makes a desire of mine, mine. And the answer that Frankfurt gives is I can call a desire mine if and only if I desire to have that desire. Otherwise, it is like being haunted, and this is why this is a wonderful case of how it comes for addiction, lack of self-control, bad habits, all the terrible things we do, right? Where we want to say, that's not me acting. Well, it's sort of me and not me. But notice that the notion of mindness is now beginning to get very complicated. So something about having a relationship to my own desires turns out to be, that is, having a self-conscious relationship to my desires, turns out to be a necessary condition for thinking of them as mine at all. So, unless a person, and now these two things now go together with the two springs of action theory, because if I had only desires, but not second order desires, then there'd only be instrumental reason. To have the capacity for reflective self-evaluation, be able to ask the question, are these desires mine? Are they worthy of me? Are they worthy of anyone? Or so on and so forth, means we have a second form of reasoning, namely ends reasoning, reasoning about ends themselves, apart from the desires that are given. Step one. Step two. Frankfurt presents the capacity for reflective self-awareness monadologically. He just takes it as, that's the way folk are. In his wonderful account of wantons. Wantons are the kind of beings who don't care what their desires are. So roughly everyone under six is a wanton. and it's what's terrifying about children, right? It's that the thought that there's a question about whether they should want their own desires just doesn't arise, right? And of course, when you find it in adults, say every narcissistic male you've ever met, then right, it's the same terrifying experience. Okay. So I think this idea, reflective self-evaluation. Now, individuals, which are persons, have these second-order desires, and hence they have the capacity to act on them as second-order volitions, that is, to will, to have a certain will. In commenting on Frankfurt's thesis, another reductivist, Daniel Dennett, says the following. He says that, as opposed to any first-order desire, that is, doing something to bring it about that one acquires a first-order desire, he says, is acting upon oneself just as one would act upon another person. One schools oneself, one offers oneself persuasions, one stands toward oneself, and access to oneself in these cases is essentially the same as one stands toward and access to another. Self-consciousness is consciousness of self as another may have it. And this requires that we logically distinguish acting on first-order desires from acting on second-order desires. We might say that acting on first-order desires is unequivocally first-personal, while acting on second-order desires is third-personal. And hence, we are in relationship to ourselves in the relation of both the first and third person, both subjects and objects. Well, what's missing here is that Frankfurt says this occurs just as if, magically, one were acting on another person. For Hegel, and indeed for all developmental psychology and psychoanalysis, one cannot take an objective stance toward oneself, one cannot take the stance of another toward oneself, unless another has already taken that stance toward one. That is, discipline is something we do not easily submit to. One learns to school oneself by first being schooled by another. In order to act on second-order desires, one must first learn to repress first-order desires, and it is through recognition of this dependence on the other which affords persons this possibility. So the capacity for self-evaluation occurs through the discipline provided by the experience of slavery. And acting on ends that are not one's own. And really the simple answer is they can't come from anywhere else because there is nowhere else.
A religious discipline.
There is no God.
There is no God. I'm not saying, but I mean the idea.
No, but you can't even have an idea of God before you have other people. There is no God. We are the source of the ideas of God.
Yeah, sure.
And we have to explain them. We have to explain it. And we're going to explain it when we get to the unhappy consciousness. The idea of God is a late version of the dual consciousness. God is one half of our divided consciousness. But it's our divided consciousness. Our divided consciousness. Begin where we are. You can't just imaginatively cook this stuff up.
It just seems like it could be a part of the fear, the fear of death, which is a baseless fear. The necessity of somebody actually attacking you or somebody being a threat to you is not necessary.
You're forgetting you were once a baby. You were once a child. This is why I started at the beginning by saying you must, in order to see the structure of this, you must put it back into a developmental psychological account of socialization, how people develop these structures. So of course, and I want to insist with you, that God's going to play a terribly important role. The unhappy consciousness is going to be the structure of most of Western subjectivity. But it is itself a structure, it's a displaced formation of self-consciousness, not its source. It's what we do with self-consciousness in its hobbled form. So we have to be able to account for it, explain it. So it has to have explanatory power. So the simplest explanation of how we can act towards ourselves like another, I'm suggesting is because another did it. That's the simplest explanation. And remember the methodologically, our rule is argument for the simplest explanation. Not the only explanation, the simplest one. I haven't ruled out demons, angels, hallucinations, but in fact this actually coheres with human experience. It's the simplest explanation. So, the thought here is that acting on ends that are not one's own. One learns that ends are not given, first order desires, irrevocably. Effective desires can be altered and eliminated, and different desires can be generated. Master and slave are not simply social roles, they are functioning features of self-consciousness itself. So mastery and slavery can be components of self-consciousness only because self-consciousness, and this is the thesis, is neither an individual capacity nor a social role, but the primary mode in which individuals act as social beings. Let me give you an example. Simple example. Master says, I want a grape. Slave goes off to the kitchen, to the fridge, gets the grape, gives it back. Who acts? Only the slave? I mean, there's a sense in which, and this is Hegel's claim, every human action is a we act. Remember, it's an I that is a we, and it is a we that is an I. And I want to say about the master-slave now, every action of master or slave is exactly that. Every action is a we act, and it is done by an individual. But because that individual is already mediated in relationship to itself, because I is another, because my desires are the desires of another, then my act is a we act. There is no I without the we. So the notion so we get, you know, I mean, this is where Lacan gets his kind of fundamental little theorems. The I is an other. Well, that's because when I act, it's the other who acts through me. And when the other acts, or, again, this is from Lacan, from a creed, the ego is always seen by the eyes of another when it looks at itself, since without this other, that is its image, it would not see itself. We are ourselves in otherness. It's going to be a huge theme later on. Okay. I've got two or three more steps here before I go to Derrida. We can go in for, can I keep going or should we have a break? Do you have patience for another kind of 10 minutes?
Sure.
Someone said sure. Okay, let's do that and then we'll make some money. I think you just made a lot of enemies.
Sure. <Okay. laughs>
It is only another kind of 7-10 minutes. Okay. Hegel's analysis has one further distinguishing feature. Still trying to think about mindness here. Frankfurt and Dennett treat reflective self-awareness as simply an abstract capacity. Hegel demonstrates that the capacity for reflective self-evaluation is embedded in the transformation of random activity into work. I haven't yet gone on to this thing. This is where I'm heading. The building thing. And this, in a way, makes perfect sense. One cannot theorize different orders of desire. First order desire, second order desire, reflective. Different springs of action. Right? I'm trying to understand how there are two orders of action. One cannot theorize that without the differential modes of activity which relate to those desires. And to theorize work and desire is also to theorize the objects of work and desire. The socialization of nature within us is mediated by and mediates the socialization of nature without. Learning to repress first-order desires is learning to repress the given, both within and without, and that involves learning that activity not only changes, alters, and destroys things, it makes, forms, and shapes new things, things never imagined. And when we do that, when we form and shape, when we make things, we are giving objective actuality to our interior life. So Hegel says, the shape the slave produces, the shape, the gestalt the slave produces, does not become something other than himself through being made external to him. Think about what it is to make something. You make it. Right? You externalize it. In externalizing it, does it become something absolutely other than you? On the contrary, Hegel says, for it is precisely this shape that is his pure being for self, which in this externality is seen by him to be the truth. That is, he creates something independent of the authority of nature. He creates an artifact. And the creation of that artifact, in seeing that, for the first time, he sees his independence from nature. The very thing that he could not achieve in the battle, right? Freedom from the authority of nature, he gets or begins to achieve through work, because making a human world in accordance with ideas is beginning to produce things that are exactly human in their shape and form. But with one problem, of course. Namely, the master owns them. That's going to cause problems. We'll come back to that problem. It's why there is stoicism, skepticism, and happy consciousness. Because he does this, he achieves a certain type of independence, and yet does not at the same time. Right? It's like being an adolescent. Right? Both free and self-moving and completely under the grip of a tyrannical master. I had a bad adolescence. So, the objects are a making, a building of the world, and that world is a reflection of me. So it is a building of the subject, a learning process by means of which the subject is formed into something different than he was at the beginning. This is why. So now, as Pinkard rightly says about this, the slave is now in a position to reflect on his own activity and to see that the natural objects of the world count as things of worth only to the extent that he, the slave, integrates them into a scheme satisfying desire. Mine. It's just that it's not his desire. But anyway, satisfying desire. And in doing that, the slave constructs a social, quasi-objective point of view out of his subjective point of view. So, and furthermore, as I've already mentioned, the master must coordinate his desires with the slave now, right? Yeah, I want what the slave wants. So the necessity, notice the necessity here that the master and the slave have to coordinate themselves, hence the necessity for a common objective point of view is established. Not the existence of one, but the necessity of a common and objective point of view. That is, if there's ever going to be a world without only masters and slaves in it. Point one. Point two. Hegel, at the end of the chapter, wants to understand the push of this necessity and therefore goes back to the question of the fear of death, which is where I began this hour. Let's call it this long hour. So Hegel says at the end of the chapter, as if he had just been reading Being in Time, if consciousness, fashions the thing without the initial absolute fear, it is only an empty, self-centered attitude. For its form or negativity is not negativity per se, not being for self negativity, just doing things isn't negativity per se, and therefore its formative activity cannot give it a consciousness of itself as a central being. Roughly, it's kind of das Mann, just any old one. That is, unless it does not have a sense of necessity, that is the authority of death, and the authority of authority, that is the meaning of self-consciousness, it is just acting out of routine. Hence, intellectual structure within self-consciousness that places it within its sociality. And it's only in relationship to this structure that we can have a reflective relationship to ourself as to be truly self-conscious beings. Okay, let's have a break. Think about all that. We can see where we are.